Today we've got a very, very distinguished guest. Dr. Joseph Nye is the co-founder of the International Relations Theory of Neoliberalism and founder of the theory of soft power, which he developed in the late 1980s and has been studied widely at universities and foreign policy institutes all over the globe. He served under several U.S. presidents, including Jimmy Carter, as the Undersecretary of State for Security Assistance, Science, and Technology, and he also served under the Bill Clinton administration as the Assistant Secretary of Defense. He's also the former dean of the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and author of many, many books in his field. We also have John Kaiser, a friend of the podcast and who's a distinguished UK civil servant. Stay tuned for the full discussion coming up.
Joe, just recently read your new book, A Life in the American Century, and I wanted to come in at a slightly different angle that I guess most podcasters and interviewers would come from, to try and get to the reason for its purpose and what you hope to serve from it. By any measure, you've led an extraordinary life, and you remain the preeminent US foreign policy scholar of our generation, of our time. I remember when I took your class at the Kennedy School very well, you often spoke to us about, in every leader's life, and a particularly president's life, there's a crucible moment that defined that person's life. And I just was wondering, when I was reading your book, was there such a defining moment in the young Joe Nye's life that paved the way for your distinguished public service career?
I think there were two crucibles. One was when I was about 20 years old and a university student and spent the summer working in a mining camp in British Columbia on the Alaskan border. And there are all the things that made one feel confident or not confident in a university setting, how you excelled or in your studies or did not excel on the athletic field. All these things were totally irrelevant. Question is, could you lift a creosoted timber and wedge it into place to keep the walls of the mine from crumbling down? And having a summer in which working with laboring people with a totally different merit system, I think it had an extraordinary effect on developing a sense of independence. I suppose the other similar crucible, which is more obvious, is when I went into the Carter administration in 1977 and was put in charge of the policy on nonproliferation. I was like the child who's thrown into the swimming pool, and if you don't swim, you sink. As an academic, suddenly trying to work with a whole series of people who had years and years of government experience and who particularly didn't want me to reorganize their thinking of their life. That was also a crucible. Those are two I would think of, and both of them I described somewhat in the memoir.
Thank you. I found reading it, A Life in the American Century, I found it beautiful, and I also found it poignant, if I may say so, in equal measure, very reflective. And quite simply, I've not read anything quite like it. May I ask, and you referenced the Carter administration, your work on the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and you go into great depth about that in your book and the challenge that remains to this day. Can I ask, what is your proudest achievement, if I may? And also, an unusual question, your happiest moment during your life in the American century?
Well, the happiest moment, I think, was my marriage or the birth of my first child.
Yes.
But in governmental terms or professional terms, probably it was being recognized by the Secretary of State with a Distinguished Service Medal for the work that I'd done. When I came into the Carter administration, the conventional wisdom was that we were entering a plutonium economy. The oil crisis of 74 made everybody say we're going to have nuclear power.
Yes.
People were projecting 600 reactors in the next decade or so, and not enough uranium to fuel them. Therefore, we would have to have commercial traffic of plutonium, which is a weapons usable fuel. We took the view that that wasn't necessary. We wanted nuclear power worked through a once through fuel cycle, leaving the plutonium locked up in the spent fuel. That was anathema when we started. I was beaten about the head and shoulders by the nuclear industry, by senators and congressmen who were beholden to that view. interview and told that our policy was totally wrong. And after 2 years, I think there was a general feeling that we had slowed things down. We'd also reversed a couple of controversial deals where France had sold a processing plant for plutonium to the Pakistanis and yes. Germany had sold an enrichment plant to the Brazilians. At the end of my 2 years leave from Harvard, there people said, well, this seems to be doing some good. And that's when I got the award. It was a feeling that what I had been trying to do made a difference and that I had to swim against the tide. I mean, it was not a popular idea. I managed to proceed upstream despite the strong currents against me. That was a sense of considerable satisfaction, the feeling that I'd made a difference.
Thank you.
Incredible. Dr. Nye, unrelated to nuclear, so I think in the book you mentioned about the 70-year sort of nuclear taboo that resulted in lots of countries not doing a lot of nuclear proliferation. Do you think that sort of taboo affected the way nuclear power plants are built today? Specifically, nuclear energy is considered quite clean, quite green, quote unquote. I've been looking at some of the charts of the nuclear power cost to create a nuclear power plant in the United States and the UK. It's almost 5x longer and costlier than places like India and South Korea as well. So do you think that sort of taboo caused us not to invest in sort of nuclear energy and clean fuels?
Well, I think there's a danger, but the bigger cause of the increase in price of nuclear was the accidents, first at Three Mile Island in the U.S. and then at Chernobyl in the Soviet Union, which essentially the public insisted on a different form of engineering and a much tighter permitting. In the Carter administration, we made clear that we were pro-nuclear energy. We weren't pro-plutonium. And sure, that probably had some costs, but I don't think it was the major source of the costs. And I think we still would argue that nuclear energy is important for the reasons that you want. We face a climate crisis, but the question of the safety engineering was the big driver of the cost increase.
That makes sense, really. In terms of the American century, so you wrote two books. This is your second book on the American century. Do you think that the American century is over? Many of your contemporaries, I think, mentioned that it's showing all the signs of a declining empire. It's overstretching wars, it can't win, internal divisions, losing currency monopoly, addiction to debt. So what's your thought basically going into the 21st century?
First of all, let's start with what is the American century was it? And the phrase comes from the publisher of Time Life, Henry Luce, in 1941, in which he argues that the United States is going to be the most powerful country in the world and that it can't continue in the isolationist mode that it had, which allowed the rise of fascism and Nazism in the 30s. And when World War II ends, the United States is indeed much more powerful than other countries. It has about half the world economy and the only nuclear weapon. Well, that nuclear monopoly ends in 1949, and the American share of the world product returns to about a quarter of the world product by 1970. So you could say, yes, that's clearly decline. But the interesting thing is that the American share of the world product was about 25% before World War II and is about 25% today. So in a sense, what was anomalous was this blip of extraordinary disproportion of the United States in the period after World War II. Basically, what happened is the United States economy was boosted by the war and all the others were laid low by the war. And as the others recovered, the American share of world product basically returned to what you might call normal. So if you take a measure like that, if you measure from 1945 to 1970, clear decline. If you measure from 1970 to 2020, it's more like a plateau. If instead you take a different measure, which is American influence or soft power, then you see more hills and valleys. America is very unpopular after invasion or the Vietnam War. Then it recovers, and then it becomes very unpopular after the invasion of Iraq, and then it recovers. And I suspect if Trump is elected or reelected, it'll become very unpopular again. But I also suspect it'll probably recover. It depends what measure you're using as to whether the American century is over or not. I think it's not over, but I think it's just going to be very different.
Interesting. When you say different, do you mean it's a more sort of multipolar world with China and Russia and some of the other countries coming in?
I would argue that you're going to have more players in the game. Some people call this the rise of Asia because the Asian countries become a larger portion of the world economy. Again, historically, if you go back to, let's say, 1500, that's a return to normal, where Asia was indeed a much larger portion of the world economy, and it falls behind when the Industrial Revolution hits Europe and America. So you could argue that the world is returning to more normal proportions between Asia and the rest. But when we talk about Asia, China is obviously the most dramatic case, but India is now close behind, and countries like Indonesia are rising. And let's not forget that when we talk about Asia, it was Japan which really led the way after the Meiji Revolution in the mid or late part of the 19th century. So I think you're not going to go back to a world in which the Americans are as dominant as they were in the latter part of the 20th century. I think Asia is going to play a much more significant role. If you ask where did that growth of Asia's share of the world product or world economy come from, as I mentioned, it was not so much at the cost of the Americans as of the Europeans. In other words, if you look at shares of world product, it's Europe that has really declined as Asia has risen.
Can I jump in there? Yeah. You know, Joe, I'm interested. You've spent your entire public career thinking about how US political values and culture and diplomacy and statecraft in particular can project American smart power. And you've just referenced the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And of course, you know, one of the things that you often point out, one of the high points of American diplomacy was that incredible coalition that President George Bush Sr. put together in the fight to liberate Kuwait in 1991. Can I ask you, and obviously the end of the Cold War was a golden moment, what do you think has been the biggest foreign policy achievements and failures over the last 30 years since the end of the Cold War?
Well, ironically, they were by presidents who were both named Bush, which my best and worst example. The senior Bush, H.W. Bush, basically presided over the collapse of the Soviet Empire and the reunification of Germany inside NATO without a shot being fired. That was extraordinarily adept diplomacy. I think that was probably one of the greatest successes of the second, you know, essentially the second half of the 20th century. And so I would give him full credit on that. But ironically, as I suggested, the hubris which the younger Bush, George W. Bush, thought that he could reshape the Middle East by overthrowing Saddam Hussein in Iraq, that was a disaster. So I would note that it proves one thing, which is that foreign policy is not determined genetically.
Thank you.
Just for our listeners, it'd be important to understand one of the key concepts of soft power versus hard power that Dr. Joseph Nye founded. There are two types of power that he talks about. One is in the camp of a hard power, and one is the camp of the soft power. The hard power can be broken down into, say, military as well as economic. So think about military in terms of number of troops, the number of defense spending a country has, or the number of ammunitions and tanks and fighter jets and drones and everything that a country has. Economic power, on the other hand, is the size of their economy that they can use to induce or coerce certain other economies, you know, that are there really as trade relationships. In terms of soft power, you have the power of attraction and agenda setting. And soft power can be broken down into sort of three resources, the sources of soft power. It's the culture in places where it's attractive to others. So think about Tom Cruise movies early on and Top Gun that are there, where it shows a very sort of attractive American culture. There's also political values when they live up to them. So the idea of a free democracy that are there, that human beings are free. So these are political values, which are part of soft power. And there's also foreign policies as well, which can be a source of soft power if used well. Dr. Nye combines both the concept of soft power and hard power into something called a smart power. States which are smart, know when to utilize hard power, which is the military, which is their economy, and then the other times they use the softer powers, which is appeal and attract other nation states and other people to their views and to what they want to convince them of. Dr. Nye, I think what you referred to as that soft power can decrease and increase in a given period of time, and that's entirely fine. You know, it has nothing to do with where your country is in terms of a trajectory and overall power. Just like the Iraq War, the foreign policies were very, very unpopular, let's say, all over the world. Do you feel like it's something similar right now with the American support for Israel's current war in Gaza, where you see like the ICJ trials set up by South Africa and others? Do you feel like, again, there's this sort of decrease in soft power because of the foreign policy of the U.S.?
One has to go back a step earlier and look at the way Israel responded to the October atrocity. And you could argue that Israel had a right to defend itself. But I think what they did is they did it in such a disproportionate way in terms of killing Palestinian women and children, that Israel basically undercut its soft power. And that, as Biden has defended Israel, and I would assert that we should defend Israel for historical reasons and moral reasons, but it should not have been the extent to which Netanyahu was given a blank slate or allowed to do the things he did. There's a big difference between sending in special forces troops to attack Hamas terrorists who engaged in atrocities and dropping 1,000-pound bombs in densely. So I think that has cost Israel a great deal of its soft power. And by extension, that has hurt American soft power. Now, Biden has been trying to send messages to Netanyahu to propose a two-state solution for the long run, to insist on greater provision of humanitarian aid and so forth. But it's not enough.
Yeah, that makes sense, really. That makes sense. Moving swiftly forward, in terms of the internal situation in the U.S., really, so I think you mentioned that you feel like people feel that polarization is quite high right now inside the U.S., but as a child, when you're growing up, polarization was as high as during the time of FDR, you know, and right after the Great Depression. Do you feel that Americans are more polarized now, or is it just, again, a reversion to the mean of what was before?
Well, I think we are more polarized because there's less middle there. I mean, Americans were extremely polarized in the past. I mean, I mentioned growing up in a rural town where there were no Democrats, no African Americans, and where the local Republican view of Franklin Roosevelt, who today is seen as a hero, was that he was a tyrant. It's clear we've been polarized in the past. I think the difference today is that you're seeing an erosion of the middle. In Congress, let's say 20 years ago, there were severe political or great political differences, but there were also a number of politicians and senators, congressmen, who were able to cross the aisle, so to speak, and work together. It's much harder now. When a Republican moderate with a Democrat, there's a much greater tendency to punish them. The so-called MAGA Republicans who follow Trump call these moderate Republicans rhinos, Republican in name only, and they run MAGA candidates against the rhinos in primary elections where only the most extreme voters tend to turn out. And that basically leads to weeding out of the center. So I think that is different. I mean, it's always been there to some extent, but I think it's gotten much more severe.
Thanks, Joe. One of the issues, I guess, in the middle ground, and you spoke very elegantly earlier about, you know, rather than talking about the rise of China and the rise of Asia, you speak about the recovery of the East to an historical position that it used to hold until relatively recent in history. And that made sense to me. And I think it's an important distinction. But one of the things that I think that will be perhaps front and center in the election is the issue of rivalry with China and competition with China. And I know you and Graham Allison at the Kennedy School have been working on the Thucydides study. And I remember the famous dictum, the strong will do what they will and the weak must suffer what they must. Do you think that, given, you know, using that PRISM, that methodology, the Thucydides trap, do you think an armed conflict between the United States and China can be averted?
I think it can be averted. Graham and I have both written about the example of Thucydides and the fact that he attributed the Peloponnesian War to the rise of the power of Athens and the fear it created in Sparta. And many people have said, well, the rise in the power of Athens, China, and the fear it creates in the U.S. will likewise lead to a violent conflict. I don't think so. I think that neither China nor the U.S. poses an existential threat to the other. I think both are too big to be invaded or really changed dramatically by the other. So if accommodation should, in fact, be possible, and the danger then is that too much fear leads to inappropriate reactions or exaggerated reactions in times of crises that could occur, say, over Taiwan. So I've argued that the real analog and danger we face is 1914, where the great powers thought they would have a short, sharp war, miscalculated, and wound up with 4 years of the First World War, which led to the end of four empires and thrones. So I think the big existential threat that U.S. and China pose to each other is that kind of miscalculation under an atmosphere of exaggerated fear. So I think the Thucydides warning is a warning rather than a prediction. It warns us to be more cautious.
Yeah, you talk about predictions, and perhaps a little unfairly, I'm going to ask you to make one prediction. 2 years ago, I was at a NATO conference, and with NATO chaplains, interestingly talking about just war and interoperability in NATO. One of the British generals said that NATO faces four challenges. He called them the four R's. Retail, and he included China in that. Refugees, because of climate change, which you referenced earlier. And radicalism, or radicals. And the last one, was Russia. The conference was just before the Russian war in Ukraine. Drawing upon your experiences and expertise from the American century, how do you believe the Russian war in the Ukraine will end or be resolved? Do you have a feeling either way?
I like his four R's, but notice how different each is from the other. But if we focus on the Russian R, I think one starts by realizing that in the long term, Russia is a country in decline. It's in demographic decline, and it hasn't adjusted to what's sometimes called the fourth industrial revolution of using information technology to transform its society. And it's now, what, about a tenth the size of the Chinese economy. And I think in a declining state, there is a greater willingness to accept risk. And I think Putin, with his backward-looking view of Ruski Mir, Russian world, which includes Ukraine, thought that invading Ukraine would solve these problems. I don't think it has. So then the question is, what does one predict? I don't think Putin is going to accept defeat, and I don't think Ukraine can administer militarily a defeat. At the same time, I think Ukraine's strong enough to prevent Putin achieving his original goal, which was to take over all of Ukraine, or at least have a puppet government there. And so I suspect at some point there'll be a negotiation. You might get what's sometimes called a Korean solution, where you'll have a demilitarized zone policed by perhaps OSCE peacekeepers or something of that sort. That means that you'll still have a Putin on territory which Ukraine thinks of as its own, like the Donbass and Crimea, and it won't mean a long-term legal recognition of those borders, but like the border on the Korean Peninsula, it'll become de facto a stabilized boundary. And what that did in the Korean case was allow South Korea to boom and to rush ahead and to find itself firmly allied with the U.S. Nobody knows the answers on Ukraine, but the prospect of a Korean-type solution in which you have a demilitarized zone which isn't a de jure legal boundary, which is stable enough to allow a part of the country to grow mightily and have strong ties with other democratic countries, is a possibility.
Let me ask the hard question for you, Dr. Nye. Should Ukraine be entering into the NATO or not?
Not now. I mean, clearly with a war going on, other NATO countries are not going to accept accept the risks that having Ukraine within NATO posed. So I don't think there's a chance that it would ever get the acceptance now. At some point in the future, it may be possible.
Yeah. Well, what do you make the argument of a few other colleagues of yours, like John Mearsheim and others, that because the neutrality of Ukraine was taken away, that's why Putin sort of went in? And
John is a friend and a bright fellow, but I think he's greatly oversimplifying history.
Right.
Notice that he had already made his speech at Munich and basically defying the West at long before the 2008 invitation for Ukraine to join NATO. And if you look at his writings in 2021, in which he talks about the fact that Ukraine was never a legitimate independent state, but was always a part of Russia, it suggests that John greatly oversimplifying. NATO expansion has obviously been a useful excuse for Putin, but I think even without NATO expansion, which incidentally wasn't going to happen, and Putin knew it, the same result would have occurred.
Staying within foreign policy, Dr. Nye, in your book, you mentioned about obviously soft power and the private dinner you had in Beijing with the foreign minister of China, I believe, who asked you how could China increase its soft power. Now, when we think about China, we think that, yeah, it's got tremendous amounts of hard power, growing military, economically, you know, it's doing pretty well as well. What is the reason that China couldn't increase their soft power to a level where it sort of competes with the rest?
Well, China does have a good deal of soft power. In traditional Chinese culture is very attractive. And China also gets attraction through its Belt and Road Initiative and aid programs and so forth. So we shouldn't think that they don't have any soft power. But when you look at polls that are taken where countries are asked, or the public in countries are asked, which other countries you find attractive, China doesn't do particularly well, except in Africa. But in Asia, Europe, Latin America, it's not getting a very good return on its investment. And it's investing very heavily in trying to develop soft power through Confucius Institutes and aid programs in the Belt and Road, and so forth. And I think the two reasons for that are, if you look at Asia, China has major border disputes with a number of its neighbors. It's very hard to have a lot of soft power in India after you start a Confucius Institute if your troops are killing Indian troops on the Himalayan border. The other thing that limits Chinese soft power is the insistence on tight party control over everything, including non-governmental organizations and industries. And that is not attractive in the democratic countries like Europe and Australia, Japan, and so forth. My advice was negotiate solutions with your neighbors and ease up on tight party control. But I mean, I think the advice is correct, but frankly, I think it was useless to him.
Yeah. Do you mean to say that having a free, open, liberal society is super important in terms of increasing soft power in a country?
Well, I think it helps, but for soft power depends on the eye of the beholder. And being an open liberal society may not help you much in Zimbabwe. I mean, if you're dealing with a country which is ruled by autocrats and is going to continue to be autocratic, then saying, look, we have a democracy, that's not necessarily all that attractive. But in countries where you have a tradition of open and democratic societies, take Australia as one of China's neighbors, or take Europe as an area that China wants to improve its trade relations with, then if China were more open and democratic, it would, I think, do better.
In terms of increasing soft power, so if I was the prime minister of a small country, and there are more small countries in the world, and there are like big countries, I think there are only 11 countries with more than 100 million population. How would the state going about thinking of, okay, how can we increase soft power? Is it just opening up more institutions like British Council and Confucius Institute and investing more in maybe like television and other things to get their culture out? Or is there a way to do that artificially, sort of?
There are a number of small states which have considerable soft power, despite their small size. If you take Norway, which is only 5 million people, Norway has a society which is very attractive, relatively egalitarian, major role for women. It provides a 1% of its economy for development assistance. This makes Norway able to punch above its weight, as the saying goes. Or if you take a different kind of society, which is not particularly democratic, but also about 5 million in size, surrounded by larger countries, think of Singapore. Singapore as an orderly society, a prosperous society, a degree of openness, not full democracy, but has played a role in ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and a role with its neighbors in terms of assisting them. Take the role of the National University of Singapore in providing scholarships for students from its neighboring countries, which again has allowed it to punch above its weight. So it's not the size of your population, it's how you use your resources to attract others.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, if I may, ask about my own country, Joe, the United Kingdom, which takes enormous pride in its soft power. And yet there's a sense, I burst out laughing when I read your book about Boris Johnson, because I also had an encounter with it, with the mayor of Johannesburg when he was the mayor of London. And I loved it when you wrote, he's a piece of work like his father. I towered of laughter when I read that. But there is a sense, Joe, and I think you know this, in the United Kingdom, that a bit like in the United States, that we've lost our mojo a little bit. And we're looking at the rise of the West. We're a country that's been, like the United States, been beset by populism. And I know it's oversimplistic to compare Trump and Johnson. And also, we also add the impact of Brexit. How can the United Kingdom revive its arsenal, if I can use that word, of smart power, and recover its standing in the international community outside of the European Union?
I think Brexit was a mistake, and I think Britain would have been stronger if it had remained in the European Union, but that's now something that's passed. Smart power is the ability to combine in hard and soft power in ways where they reinforce each other rather than undercut each other. Britain has a fair amount of soft power, which comes from its traditions, its culture, its universities. This is somewhat ironic. If you look at the popularity of the British monarchy in the United States, which of course rebelled against King George, it's quite extraordinary. I mean, Americans want to watch British coronations. Or if you look at the traditions of political liberties, in the common law, we go back to British traditions. If you look at British universities and the role that British universities played and still play. These are all significant sources of soft powers. As I say somewhere in the memoir, as somebody who spent 2 years at Oxford, I'm a victim of British soft power. I think Britain does well. I think it hasn't done as well in combining its soft and hard power as it might, and leaving the European Union reduced the economic aspects of British hard power. It's interesting, if you look at, there's a company called Brand Finance, which does a rating of countries every year in soft power, and the latest one ranked Britain about second, I think. It's not doing as well as it could, but it's not doing all that badly.
Thank you.
In terms of crafting soft power and hard power to smart power, Dr. Nye, the improvements in technology and AI recently has basically taken us over. You see the Gen AI and OpenAI and others. So what do you think technology and AI kind of does to the advantages of soft power and hard power for any country, basically?
Well, I think AI is something of an amplifier. It takes things that are existing and exaggerates and amplifies them. And it can amplify both good and bad. In other words, if it leads to more efficiency and economic growth, that's good. If it leads to erosion of trust in society and more problems with elections, that's bad. In that sense, AI ought to be seen as an instrument, and like many instruments, can be used for good or for ill. The association, though, of a country with development of new technologies can often be a source of soft power. And there, I think the fact that the Americans have a dynamic society and economy, which has led them to be at the forefront, particularly of generative artificial intelligence, has affected American soft power. But whether the net effect is going to be good or bad for others will depend on how it is used.
Yeah, that makes sense in a lot of ways. And you feel that with the coming of new sort of technology and AI and everything else, that it's harder to have a democratic country run well because of that, because the nature of fragmented media, like previously, and like I think you were talking about the first Gulf War, where CNN and BBC could control what's happening there and control the narrative. Right now, obviously, there's like Twitter, there's like, you know, different Truth Social and different sort of things, which is very like decentralized media. Do you think it's harder for nations to generate consensus, because democracy is about consensus, right? So do you think the nature of these decentralized technologies means that democracy is in peril in 21st century?
Well, I think it's certainly challenged, yes. If you look at the effect of the internet and the web, this antedates AI, but the development of what you might call opinion bubbles, in which one set of people will listen to one set of views and another set of people listen to another set of views. And this can be not just a few, but can be a multitude. That makes it harder to develop a consensus. But I think what AI or generative AI adds to this is the feeling of manipulation. In other words, if you can use false pictures that are very realistic, and if you can generate narratives instantaneously about a politician which are false, the viewer or listener doesn't know what to trust anymore. And democracy does require a degree of trust. If the fact you have more opinion bubbles and fragmentation of opinion and algorithms which fracture consensus, that we should blame on the internet and social media. But the loss of trust that comes from manipulation of these media, I think that is the great new danger of generative AI.
Thanks, Joe. And just building on that question, looking slightly to the future, America famously innovates. It's what America's famous for in the world. You spoke about British tradition, but the United States innovates. When you think of your grandchildren, will Generation Z be able to reinvent and reinvigorate America and build a bridge to the next century? Probably not based upon American exceptionalism, but at least American foundational principles, culture, and values.
It's a real challenge for them. The question of how do you maintain traditional values in terms of political equality and liberty and openness when you have these tools which allow manipulation as they do, it's going to take a more sophisticated public in terms of being able to manage it. Fortunately, there are a lot of younger people who are becoming aware of this or studying it, who will be writing the books and articles which deal with it, which I will no longer be capable of doing. One has to hope that there's enough resilience in the society that they will think of solutions or ways to preserve some degree of trust. For example, just to take that, one will have to place much more emphasis on provenance of films or of emails and so forth. Then you'll have to think of what are the ways in which you assure provenance. In the art world or the art market, provenance is crucial. And there's a lot of art cheating. I mean, a lot of Vermeers that are sold that are not Vermeers or Rembrandts or whatever. On the other hand, it has become a workable market. The questions of how you will make sure that the provenance of an email or of a picture, a video, is one where you can have some trust is going to take a lot of interesting work and creativity. I'm not capable of doing it, but there are people in the younger generation who can. It's a major problem that you raise, but I have some faith in the resilience of institutions that we may be able to at least cope with it.
Yeah, and just to drive home the depth of the problem, really, just for our audience, I'm just going to flip this open. So this is a Wall Street Journal article I came across, which shows between 1998 to 2023, the American values and how they're sort of declining or sort of changing. So they surveyed patriotism is high 60s, mid 60s. Now it's almost halved. Religion, having children, community involvement. The only thing that's increased within Gen Z is, I guess, money. When we talk about American values translating into great soft power, what is sort of American values going forward and some of the challenges that are there? So it's quite interesting.
Well, and I think of that is reinforced by, let's say, Trump's return to the presidency, in which he has not had a tradition of valuing institutions and playing off these other values in a very populist way, it's a real problem. I'm not ignoring that. But on the other hand, I think that there still is some resilience in attitudes in society.
I guess to bring it full circle, I know we don't have much longer with you. You mentioned earlier that you're having dinner with Condoleezza Rice this evening. And,
yes.
An amazing public servant.
I'm going to have to leave for that quite soon.
I know. An amazing servant, but from the Republican side, but highly regarded. When you sit down with her tonight, do you think that, you know, without, do you look to the future, both of you, in your conversations with optimism?
I think a degree. I think Condi gave a very interesting speech on Juneteenth that I cite in the first pages of the memoir, saying that her faith in the future rests on the fact that we've never been perfect, but that we have never given up striving. And that's built into the society. The reason I quote that is it'd be crazy to ignore all the flaws in the United States, and I list many of them, but it'd also be mistaken to not to notice that there have been periods in the past, such as the 1890s or the 1930s or the 1960s, when it looked like the United States was finished. It was all downhill, and yet there was an ability to recover from it. So, and I think we're in something of a trough now, and the question is, can we recover from this in the 2030s? Who knows? But as I say at the end of the book, I remain guardedly optimistic.
Thank you, Joe.
That's brilliant. And on that optimistic note, Dr. Nye, thank you very much for joining the Innovation Civilization podcast. We'll let you go for your dinner, and all the best for the future. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, I very much enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to the Innovation Civilization podcast. If you love the podcast, please subscribe on all major platforms, as well as please share it with your friends and family. Thank you very much for listening, and see you soon for the next episode.